Hello, you're listening to Sorted Cinema, official podcast of SortedCinema.com. This week's special guest, Les Chappell, is here to help us break down Nacho Vigalondo's hybrid genre curiosity, Colossal, starring Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello and welcome to Sorted Cinema. My name is Simon Howell. Ricky is not on the bench with us this week. He is otherwise occupied. I am, however, joined by Patrick Murphy.
I'm going to say that Ricky was lucky this time around, although who knows? Maybe he will think differently. I can never tell with him.
Well, let's not spoil the affair yet, Patrick. And who knows? Maybe one or more of us has had a massive change of heart. We're also joined, of course, by Mr. Les Chappell.
Hello. And I, for one, think I'm lucky because I am looking forward to this conversation.
I think we all are. Les, do you still have bylines at the AV Club?
Yes, I do. You can. I'm at avclub.com, just starting up coverage of season 4 of Silicon Valley and wrapping up coverage of season 2 of Superstore.
Fantastic.
So look for that.
If no one out there watches Superstore, it's an NBC sitcom, which years ago used to be a terrible, terrible thing to say, but they're doing some good stuff right now, and Superstore is fantastic. It's one of my very favorite shows.
As well it should be.
Anyway, total digression. Very happy to have you here, Les. So we are going to be talking about Nacho Vigalondo's Colossal today, and I'm going to warn you right off the bat, it's going to get contentious. I don't think there's a good way to discuss this movie without getting into full-blown spoilers, I'll be honest. I mean, the basic premise, I guess, is established in the promotional materials, but I think to get into it with any detail, we are going to have to spoil the film. So if you have a vague interest and you're spoiler-phobic, I know a lot of people are, I don't personally care about them, this is a whole discussion for another time, but, you know, you've been warned, so I just wanted to state that off the bat. And I think that's about it in terms of preamble. Do, of course, visit SortedCinema.com. You're going to see all sorts of stuff there, including my review of this film, which is, I shit you not, literally the first film review I've written in almost 4 years.
I cannot wait to read this.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it inspired me. What can I say? Anyway, so without any more ado, let's hear a clip from Nacho Vigalondo's Colossal.
You don't remember anything last night, huh?
I got really melodramatic, didn't I?
You told me that you weren't really on a vacation. That you've been looking for a job for a year and your boyfriend didn't work out.
You are out of control.
What?
I've packed your things. They're in the bedroom.
What?
And since you didn't have any money, you decided to move back here.
Is there anything else?
Don't remember anything.
The unprecedented nature of this phenomenon.
You get that tangle. You know you're watching something that's going to change the course of history. You all right?
Yeah. It's this nervous tic I have. I get this itch. Oh, my God.
Thing appeared. Same place. Exact same time. But it just made a bunch of weird hand gestures.
You got something.
It's dancing.
Is dancing like?
Holy shit.
Ow! What was that? What was that?
A helicopter.
With the pilot and everything? I feel terrible.
Give him a good show.
Keep it cool.
She's the monster.
That was a clip from our movie this week. It's called Colossal, written and directed by Nacho Vigalondo. If you're an old head of Sordid Cinema, you will know that we talked about Vigalondo's first film, Time Crimes, on the show a very long time ago. I remember it played at Fantasia in Montreal. It was a big hit there. Let's fast forward to now. This is his fourth or fifth feature. He also, of course, was a part of some horror anthologies, including one of the VHS films. This is definitely his biggest release to date, though, and it stars Anne Hathaway as an alcoholic failed writer living in New York. Is there any other kind? Who is broken up with by her boyfriend, played by Dan Stevens, and is forced to move back home to her unnamed, definitely not New York, sort of a small hamlet somewhere, where she reencounters an old friend played by Jason Sudeikis, and it's around this time that a giant monster begins to wreak havoc in Seoul, South Korea, and she quickly discovers that all these events are not in any way unconnected, and I guess we can shocker. So yeah, I guess we can
gasp.
We'll get into the metaphysics of how this all works a little bit later. So I want to start with you, Les, because I'm just going to spoil it right off the bat. Les, you really enjoyed this film. Patrick and I really did not. And I will say, Les, that you are on the side of the majority, because I never check Rotten Tomatoes, because frankly, I think Rotten Tomatoes is a disgusting institution that would greatly benefit film culture if it were to be rated by awful, like, men's rights nerds and, like, completely blown off the face of the earth. But that's a discussion for another time. but I did check this time, and I noticed that it has over 100 positive reviews out of like 130. And I would have expected the top critic breakdown to be a little different. It's not. So Patrick and I are definitely in the minority here. So Les, why did you love Colossal?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think one of the advantages I think I had going into Colossal was that I knew absolutely nothing about it beyond I haven't seen Time Crisis or any other Nacho Vigalondo film, so I didn't know any of his work. The only thing I knew about this movie was the initial launch trailer, where they show you that this is the Anne Hathaway kaiju movie. So I went into it knowing only that. So I was. What I loved about the movie was it was not the movie I expected it to be, and I meant that in a good way. Like, you go in there thinking, okay, I thought this was going to be some sort of like a quirky comedy about a woman who realizes that she's a monster in South Korea, and it starts as that, but then the story gradually changes, and Jason and Oscar, the Jason Sudeikis character's darker side starts to come out. And you realize, oh, this is not so much a story about a woman who is a monster. This is a story. This has a bunch of other factors to it. It's a story about codependent alcoholism. It's a story about abusive relationships. And I think the movie really plays the transition to that point. Like, the turning point for me came when Oscar starts insulting his friends, and he tells he chews out Garth for being a cocaine addict, and suddenly that darkness comes out, and you're like, oh, this is a very different movie than the one I expected. So I think the element of surprise, I think, is one that really works for me. And I like a film where I'm going into it and it's not the film I thought it was going to be. And so I was very pleasantly surprised. I mean, there's a lot of other things I did enjoy about the movie, and I'm sure we can go back and forth on that. But I think that that was the biggest point of the film that really grabbed me. The fact that, oh, this is a much different movie than I thought it was going to be.
All right, now Patrick, in government's opposition. Sorry, I'm back in high school debate mode now. all right, Patrick, tell Les why he's wrong, but be nice.
Well, I'm right 100% with you, Les, in that I had no idea what this movie was going to be about. I only, again, saw the trailer. That was it. So it definitely was surprising. I'm going to agree with you that it was not the movie I expected it to be. There's no question about that. It was also way, way worse than I expected it to be. I didn't think that they were going to be able to screw things up so badly with the mess of themes that they were trying to convey. This movie, to me, was just an absolute jumbled, hideous mess of trying to portray alcoholism and toxic male people that show up in a woman's life. I don't know. I it had no likable characters whatsoever. I kind of hated everybody in this movie. I hated what I thought it was trying to say. Although I with the friend that I saw it with, we endlessly discussed this the whole night. She also despised the movie. We didn't know what it was trying to say, and we kept up coming up with more bizarre theories as to every single thing that it seemed to be about, like alcoholism. It deconstructed its own stuff. It destroyed its own attempts at saying something about alcoholism to me through various plot points. The turn came way too harshly, way too fast for it to seem believable in any way. And while I did appreciate the darker aspects of this movie, I appreciate that it went for something. It was so out of left field, and it happened so quickly that it made zero sense, and the characters' reactions to everything made zero sense. So I have no idea what they were going for. It's hard for me to put my thoughts, into something coherent about this movie, because I don't think the movie had any coherence whatsoever. To me, it was just an absolute mess, and I hated like every part of it.
Patrick, we've done something like 11 or 12 podcasts together now, and I don't think you and I have ever been on quite the same page on a movie, but this time I gotta say I'm right there with you. I was planning to see another movie after this. I was planning to see Your Name right afterwards, and oh, sure. I was in such an awful mood after this was over. I was so dispirited that I could not sit through another film. I just ended up I just couldn't do it. I was baffled. I was completely, and I remain completely baffled as to how this movie is so bad. And like, I think that I don't really understand how it is that Vigalondo, who also wrote the script, was able to secure $15 million for a screenplay and an idea that was so half baked and an execution that was so shoddy. I mean, I think there's the germ of a good idea in this notion of, this self-absorbed alcoholic sort of wandering millennial whose actions have these inadvertently disastrous, even like almost genocidal consequences. So we can start to explain it. Is the sort of core mechanic of the film is that when Gloria happens to traipse through this particular park at a particular time of the morning, I believe it's 8:05. There is a window during which she manifests as this creature, and then, obviously because she's just stumbling around, she's just, like, crushing and destroying, as it turns out, like, harborfront, like, downtown Seoul, South Korea, thereby, killing hundreds and hundreds of people. And, that's kind of an intriguing idea with, like, a lot of really loaded ideas attached to it about, self-absorption and, how stories kind of privilege Western voices. And like, that's a really evocative idea. And the movie does not engage with that idea on any of the levels that it should, or at least that I think it should. Obviously I'm not the filmmaker, so he clearly disagrees. And it veers off into being this totally different movie about, like you said, alcoholism, domestic abuse, toxic masculinity. Again, these are all totally worthwhile themes for a movie. Why they're supposed to be worthwhile themes for this movie, I have absolutely no idea, and none of it is dramatized in a believable or consistent or coherent way. The character, I absolutely know you're going to hammer on this, and I want to beat you to it, Patrick. The characters are so thinly developed. Actually, the best developed character is the Jason Sudeikis character. Because
yes.
we learn that his parents died. We learn that he's a hoarder. We learn that he's deeply self-hating. We learn that
he almost got married to a woman with a kid.
Right. Almost
to,
got,
who,
yeah.
who, to a woman to whom he has scratched her face out of every one of her pictures he still has.
Yeah. We learn a lot about the Jason Sudeikis character. What do we know about Gloria? Well, we know that she has parents, but they're like mysteriously absent from their house. We know that she has a sister who calls her about news events for some reason.
Who she does not call back. I will say that that is like she never calls her sister back after that. She's like, I'm gonna have to call you back. Never does. Okay, and that is the only flaw I had in this movie.
The only flaw. Okay.
Sorry. Keep going.
I mean, we're told that she's a writer, which, by the way, that's like total screenwriter speak of if you don't care what your character does and it's not important to the movie, you make them a writer. That's like classic screenwriter trick. But we you know, we're, it's repeatedly referenced that she is or was a writer. We have no idea what she wrote about or why we're supposed to care or if she wants to be a writer again or what her ambitions are in any way. Her relationship with Tim, the Dan Stevens character, is also really, really poorly sketched out. We know nothing about Gloria. It's really strange that she's so much less developed than, you know, the character we're meant to hate is. Yeah, and speaking of thinly developed, like the supporting characters, specifically the friends of Oscar, are less than paper thin. Particularly the one who's like the ostensible love interest was almost almost offensively drawn. I don't know. There's very little about the movie that worked, and there are like ideological problems that I have with this movie. Also, on top of the fact that I think the mechanics are abhorrent. But we can get there when we get there.
And you forgot to mention that the filmmaking is extremely shoddy and bland.
Oh, yeah. I was going to get there, too. Yeah. I mean, the sequence in which, like, I don't know why the movie thought we needed an explanation of why things are happening, because I certainly didn't. But when we do get it, it is a dreadful sequence. Just awful. Less,
I'm kind of legitimately stunned that this movie couldn't just engender that much hate from you guys, because I get the points you're trying to make about how there were some, like, I will agree that there is definitely a thinness to the supporting characters. The disdain when you say Joel is well made, because he is only there to exist in basically as a trigger for Jason Sudeikis's character. But in terms, I don't, oh God, there's so much. In terms of the Gloria character, I think that I agree that she's there's a thinness to her character, but I think that's sort of, I mean, that's intended to be by design. The character is like, she's not supposed to have this well-rounded life. She's supposed to just be this kind of average fuck up who suddenly has this extraordinary, absolutely inexplicable thing happen to her. And I mean, even when they explain it, it's still pretty inexplicable. But I don't think the movie's interested in asking those questions. It's more of a, and I appreciate that it's not trying to build some grand mythology. It's just, this is a person, this thing is happening, they have to figure out how to deal with it.
I think the explanation of the actual metaphysics of how this happened were uninteresting to me, and I didn't care that the movie didn't really address it, because it's a fantasy, essentially. But when it tries to explain things like why Jason Sudeikis' character is a jerk, or why this is happening in the first place, the rage that is built up inside both of them, the bitterness in him for her kind of being successful, and the like this hidden rage in her not remembering some supposedly traumatic event that happened when she was a kid, which, by the way, if that event is what triggered all of this, that is one of the stupidest fucking explanations I've ever seen for why two people could be mad at each other and why their lives could be ruined. But what this movie kills is it's trying to work up several metaphors. Okay, so I really do like the concept of a giant monster destroying a city as being a metaphor for how alcoholism affects other people. How, you know, your own selfishness, you don't realize that you're kind of running rampant and rampaging through other people's lives because you're so self-absorbed in your own, you know, the disease sort of causes that. It's kind of an interesting idea that they completely go back on, because then they turn it into something else. Instead of focusing on the alcoholism of these two, they start to focus on, like, I don't, there's also a metaphor to her being a doll, right? The very first shot of the movie is of a Barbie doll or some sort of doll like that. And they try to make it so that all the male characters in her life, this is, again, like halfway through the movie, everybody switches. At the beginning of the movie, her boyfriend Tim is actually very reasonable. When he kicks her out, I have no problem with what he did. Like, the guy, she had been mooching off of him, and certain lines point to him actually being a decent person. You know, if you're going to make a person into an evil guy in a relationship or a selfish guy in the relationship, don't make his first line be, I never get to see you anymore, because that's actually pretty sympathetic. But halfway through the movie, everything switches, and they want all these guys to be controlling her like she is the doll. You know, the Jason Sudeikis character sends her furniture. The Joel guy sets it up in her house like it is a dollhouse. He's playing with her in a way. So it becomes this thing about manipulation. And yet the metaphor is mixed because she's manipulating everyone just as much. And I'm not sure, like, am I supposed to be rooting for her in the end? She's a horrible person too. She's playing all these people the same as they're playing her. And just because Jason Sudeikis is supposed to be, quote, the bad guy, and ooh, that the movie really emphasizes when he performs an evil deed, but kind of makes her similar violent deeds as something heroic. It totally contradicts itself in so many different spots that I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be feeling about it, or about these people, or about the whole situation in general. And nobody seems to care that a monster is rampaging through Seoul, Korea. It's like a curiosity to the entire world, and, you know, in this very small cast. So because I don't know what I'm supposed to feel about any of this, it's all confusing and so badly botched with the metaphors. There's no clear focus on anything. Instead, I just feel absolute repulsion to everything that's happening.
I didn't even think about the dollhouse element, which is like, that's a whole other layer that is not like that I don't understand just what
another underdeveloped metaphor.
Yeah, that's exactly. All
like, just another one. Let's throw another one in there.
Yeah, and I guess you could say that extends to, you know, the climax of the film when she ends up handling him as a doll. When she, you know, in the climax
now she's
of the film,
in control, right? Like now she's in control of him. Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually did not think of that one.
It would have been clever in like a good movie. Anyway.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. Like so many individual ideas or images or like concepts on some basic level are feasible or workable, but it's just the execution and the development is so haphazard.
I've read a lot of reviews, Les. I'm curious to hear your point of view because I most reviewers do agree with you, and most reviewers actually like the way that the movie pulls it off.
I know, I'm trying to put some of it together, but I'm just like floored by the sheer vitriol because I spent like a good I went to see this with a friend of mine, and we just spent a good hour talking about it. And we kind of we loved this movie.
Oh, I was going to say, I had the opposite effect. Like, I went with a friend, and she and I spent an hour and a half or 2 hours discussing how much we both hated the movie. So that's really weird.
I also have one statement I'm going to make that is probably really going to upset you guys, but I'm going to save it until we're actually into the podcast.
Oh, fun. Okay.
Perfect.
Whoop, whoop, whoop. So, yeah, I mean, I mentioned sort of the ideological problems that I have with this movie, and just to preface this, there was a really great piece by John Semley in Salon, Toronto's own John Semley, and he was talking about sort of the rise of social justice-based criticism and how, there's these issues with, conflating a movie or a work of art's goodness with how much it aligns with your political sensibilities and, you know, sort of losing sight of the, the political dimension of aesthetics and, you know, that and, you know. Anyway, I'm badly misstating his thesis, but I totally agree with it, and I think that it's, you know, it's kind of easy sometimes to dismiss stuff because, you know, it's politics don't line up with yours. So I just wanted to preface that, preface what I'm about to say with this. That being said, there are dimensions to this movie that I think are just staggeringly misjudged. Specifically the fact that, you know, what happens to Gloria and the pain that she feels and, like, you know, the guilt that she has and her remorse and then, you know, her struggle and all this. Her pain is so much more important than anything that happens in Seoul in this movie. Like, mm-hmm. we don't feel the weight of any of this tragedy. We don't see a single dead body. We don't see much more than a couple seconds of any explosions. When the Sudeikis character ends up, literally causing untold damage with his rampage near the end, it doesn't land at all because there's absolutely no depiction. This is a completely, except for what happens to Gloria, a completely bloodless and almost violence-free film. Her experience is privileged above what happens to, you know, the citizens of Seoul. Her experience is 100% privileged above theirs. There isn't even, until the very last scene, a Korean person doesn't even get a spoken line of dialogue, which for a movie that basically genocides Korea is completely obscene. Like, is this supposed to be a movie about, you know, Western self-absorption and is trying to comment on that? I didn't get that feeling from watching this film. I didn't get any scene that reflected that at all. I didn't see, there was no self-awareness to its lopsided depiction of these things. And frankly, I thought it was offensive.
And again, I didn't get that. I mean, yeah, yes, I see the, I see the argument you're making here, but I don't think that that's what the movie is. Like, the movie is not interested in the big scale. I think sort of what they're, like, just the way that she's reacting to it and depicting it and what you see about on the news broadcast, just, like, nobody knows how to deal with this. I think it's, by definition, this is supposed to be something, like, it's a disaster of such proportions that it's kind of difficult for anyone to really actually internalize it, what, and just sort of process it. So it narrows to her way that she's, to the way that she's processing it. Like, this is just one person who it's sort of like to focus on the grand scale of everything. You can't narrow it down because she's just dealing with, and I'm rambling a little bit right now, but I feel like it's by nature that the film is focusing on her experience of acknowledging she's the person causing this. And the film's not getting into the actual grand scheme tragedy of it, because it's depicting that tragedy as very, very personalized and specific. And I mean, maybe yes, that is offensive, but I don't think the movie is intending it that way.
No, I just don't think it thought about anything else. It, like the character herself, it's completely self-absorbed in its own concepts, which it doesn't pull off very well, just like her. She's such an abhorrent character. She's so self-absorbed in everything. Her guilt, like Simon says, means more to her than the deaths that happen in Seoul. When it comes to, you know, her goofing around and hitting a helicopter, she doesn't really feel much about that. But how dare Jason Sudeikis goof around a little bit? Also, you know, not killing anybody, just goofing around a little bit. She takes offense to that. How could anybody else do that? When it comes to writing the message, she wants to do it alone. It has to be her message that I'm sorry. You know, not he's not allowed to join in on this. Everything revolves around her in this world that she... somehow we're made to think that an attack upon that, or I have a theory that this movie takes place, really the story is in, she's in an insane asylum and this is all happening in her head.
Building on that thought, what if the first scene of the movie is the only scene that exists, and then she goes out to get a cab, gets struck by the car, and then the rest of the movie is just her hallucination of what will happen when she leaves? So it's a Jacob's Ladder scenario.
I would settle for the rest of the movie just being the credits at that point.
Well, if you think about her reactions to, all right, if she had some sort of mental break, she feels guilt about her, you know, her boyfriend, her life, where it's going in general. So she has this sort of like, okay, there's this happier first half of the movie, or at least first third of the movie, where she's trying to put her life back together. She's trying to become a better person, blah, 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 right? And her alcoholism, oh, she sort of feels bad about it. She sort of feels bad about things. But when real guilt is placed upon her, when it's shown to her that she's destroying lives, she turns the entire scenario around. Instead of her being sort of the villain who needs to shape up, all of a sudden every single person around her becomes the villain in some way, whether it's Jason Sudeikis who becomes a psychopath, whether it's, you know, Tim Blake's character who just goes off on a coke binge randomly when no evidence like whatsoever was shown about that beforehand, whether it's Joel, who seemingly is unable to do anything to defend her or defend anybody, whether it's her ex-boyfriend Tim, who suddenly becomes a possessive, jealous, you know, ex. Everybody turns into a villain except her. She becomes the hero of her own story. And that only happens when she realizes how much she has been destroying everything else. It's like a self-defense mechanism kicks in, and she can't be the bad guy in this story. She can't allow herself to be the bad guy in this story.
And like the way you described that, Patrick, like I keep envisioning versions of this movie that are good. Like, to me, the best possible version of this movie is sort of like the one you described. Like, if this was a movie about how, you know, people have written about the way you perceive your life. Like, do you perceive your life as a story in which you are the protagonist? Because when you perceive your life that way and you sort of otherize everyone else and you centralize yourself, you know, you can behave abhorrently. And this is, you know, a way that a lot of people envision their lives. It's sort of a natural way to envision your life, especially if you grow up watching a lot of movies and TVs and reading a lot of books. But you know, it can be quite destructive. And you know, if this film wanted to be about self-absorption and, you know, centering yourself above all others and you know, and being a movie about, you know, someone who imagines that what they do is so important that literally it endangers millions of people, like that's kind of an intriguing and novel theme. But you know, again, this is not that movie. this movie is not interested in developing that really possibly rich vein of thought and inquiry. You know, instead it's interested in being like this half-assed movie about domestic violence and alcoholism, even though this is one of the least convincing movies about alcoholism ever. Nobody even ever appears drunk.
They're getting drunk off PBR.
Yeah, I wonder how much of the 50 million came from PBR.
Hey, Jason Sudeikis drinks like an entire bottle of Jack Daniels.
He does
night.
Do the whiskey. Yeah, he does. That's true.
And I would like to sort of steer things a little bit to say, I think maybe one of the reasons why I like the films much more than you guys did was I can see the gripe as to how it suddenly goes from that one movie to being another movie, but I found the other movie more interesting. Like once you see the turn that the Jason Sudeikis character takes, and possibly this is because I didn't know Jason Sudeikis could play just as nasty as he was. And just the way that he becomes increasingly angry and, well, unhinged, for lack of a better word. But then you suddenly think back. I found myself looking back to earlier parts of the movie. Like, you can tell that he's trying to manipulate her in the later stages. But then you think back to all those scenes where it's like, oh, I'm bringing over a futon. I told you I was going to do it. I'm bringing over a TV. I told you I was going to do that. I just thought to myself, did he actually tell her any of those things?
Yes, I've heard that argument before. But the thing is, like, he also tells her, yeah, you told me all about your life. You know, you told me you broke up with your boyfriend, that you moved back here. That's stuff she must have told him, and she didn't remember saying that at all.
I think I have the theory that actually she did that one night, and then he picked up on that and realized that he could use that for gaslighting purposes.
Maybe. But the thing is, they didn't explore something like that and make it clear enough. And this movie there's a lot of vagueness to how they go about doing things. I'm with you. Sudeikis is the standout performance.
Yeah,
here,
I agree.
Because he really does convey menace really well. It's just turned too quickly. He didn't showcase enough of that beforehand. And I get the whole thing that what they're like, you could try to say that, oh, okay, some, you know, people who are addicts and whatever, you would have no idea. They seem like the nicest people until they turn on you on a dime. Like, the abusive relationships can work that way as well. You would think that person was perfectly nice until you're in a relationship with them, and then they turn on you. I get all of that. It just doesn't make sense when everyone in the community seems to turn on her.
Well, everyone in the community is like only three people.
Yeah, exactly.
In this movie, yeah.
Technically two and a half. Joel's just happy to be there.
He's just a puppy dog expression. That's all they wrote down in the screenplay. Puppy dog expression.
Yeah, generically handsome. I will say that this is an angle of defense that I have seen some people make about the film, that this is really a movie about sort of nice guy culture and how, like, you know, It's the nice ones, the superficially nice people that often turn out to be the most toxic. And, you know, this is a trope we've seen examined in like a lot of Joss Whedon stuff, and also that we've seen poorly, you know, done in a lot of other movies. And I'll give it a little bit of credit for that. I think that is kind of an interesting dimension, mostly because I completely agree that Sudeikis gives the best performance and has the most to work with in this film. Like, again, his character is comparatively richly drawn compared to literally everyone else in this movie. I was baffled at how thin the Dan Stevens character was, given, you know, how big he's gotten lately. That seemed like
they were both two different people.
Yeah, though, to be fair, she wasn't much of a breakup-y. She did keep calling him over and over again.
I mean, how possessive and jealous was he? She was the one calling him in the first half of the movie. Then all of a sudden it turns the other way around. I don't know. With him, he was drawn so completely starkly different from one half to the next. Here he's a guy who clearly has put up with this alcoholic living in his house for a long time. He goes on about how they've had the same conversation over and over again. I don't believe he's been extremely patient as opposed to controlling. She's been the one who's manipulating. What I don't like about the people who are discussing this is a male toxic, you know, kind of thing, or toxic male, nice guy, male culture or whatever. She is a toxic character. She's a horrible person who is destroying lives. I could also make the case that until she showed up in town, Jason Sudeikis had a bar, had friends. And as soon as she, you know, I was wondering, and I was talking about this with my friend, what is the significance of the Western room? It kind of is like the past in Jason Sudeikis' life. He has closed it off. Maybe that's his evil side. He was trying to get rid of it. She comes there. She forces him. She opens it up. She kind of destroys his life by opening up all these bad things that he didn't want to think about or bad ways of him acting. And in the end, she ends up just like, she ruins the guy. She turns him back into the monster that he was trying to avoid. He was actually living his life just fine until she got there. I mean, that's what it seems like anyway. There's no evidence that he was a monster around town. He seemed to have friends and was respected at least by his patrons. But she forces him to open up a part of his bar that he didn't want to, that he wanted to forget, that he wanted to change. He wanted to redo it. He ran out of money, but he wanted...
I think you've lost me on this thread, Patrick, because that's an argument I totally don't buy. I don't want to defend this movie too much, obviously. This has all gotten complicated now, but, like, I don't know. I think that gets dangerously close to victim blaming, though, because, you know, clearly...
She's not a victim. Not a victim.
Well, you know, she becomes a victim of domestic abuse when he starts beating the shit out of her.
After she beat the shit out of him. When you use violence, expect violence back. Who hit first?
Okay.
Oh, my.
I'm sorry, but she's punching and kneeing the guy in the balls, and only in the very end does he finally hit back. So what has happened here is if you're going to show somebody, she's not a victim. She's the one starting the punching. She's the one doing the violence to someone else.
Well,
make the argument that she has victimized him by doing the violence to his psyche by opening stuff up.
First of all, clearly his psyche is plenty damaged without her doing the prodding. I mean, he's living in a totally dilapidated, crammed house with these scratched out pictures. Who knows what he did to that woman to drive her away?
Her psyche is damaged too. She's a mess. They're both messes. She's no more victim than
he is. At this point is exerting a form of violence in terms of emotional and physical control by telling her, if you leave town, I'm gonna destroy South Korea. So he's at this point in the film, I agree that the turn is not believable, but he becomes this outright villain who holds this an entire part of the world hostage and her hostage with it. That is a form of violence, and if you want to talk about who struck first, he did, in that sense.
No, he didn't, because she actually started hitting him before he did.
No, I'm not talking about the literal hitting. I'm talking about this sort of like this hostage situation. He's the one who acts as the dominating force, and that is a form of violence.
I'm not so sure that I buy that, because she starts manipulating well before I think he does. Now, you could argue that his, giving her furniture and stuff is manipulation, some sort of passive aggressive manipulation.
Absolutely.
But she starts manipulating all of these people well before that happens. And it's not until after she sort of denies him his little fun, where he wants to taunt the South Koreans a little bit, and it comes to blows from her, that she. Even though she had her little drunken fun, she will not let him have that. She's already manipulated Joel at this point. I believe that she is the one that has started ruining these people's lives first. And while Sudeikis does eventually turn into a monster, there's no question about that, I don't consider her a victim because she instigated all of it and would continue to instigate. She pushed and pushed and pushed. And I can't call somebody a victim when they get pushed back against finally.
I can't agree with that at all.
Wow. Okay, first of all, this whole theory that we have just posed about the turning of the monsters, number one, this movie just got even more awesome for me. Because, again, I like that. I do like that interpretation. But the moment, one moment I just wanted to, in terms of, like, this discussion of... one moment I really did like in terms of just casting, just like the domestic violence parables. There's the moment in the bar after he's set off the giant firework and Dan Stevens' character is trying to get her to come with him. And he's like, you're not going with him. And, I think that obviously we know she can't go because he'll destroy South Korea if she does. But I thought that was an effective moment of just like the stand-in for just like other domestic violence situations where people say, you got to get out of this relationship. You got to get out of this relationship. But the other person says, I can't. And yeah. I thought that moment, particularly the performances, we've been talking a lot about Sudeikis, but I thought Anne Hathaway was terrific in this movie. I mean, yes, she's an incredibly unlikable character, but again, it's the old girl's argument. You're not supposed to like these characters. And I think both her and Sudeikis are clearly enjoying getting to play characters who are real pieces of shit. And I don't think I'm not going to dispute that Gloria is a piece of shit. But like the counterpoint to this is, you said she had her drunken fun and she stopped. She stopped once she actually realized what the hell was going on. And she's like, okay, this is a dangerous thing. I have to back off from this. And like, she's like, she's hitting him. She's hitting him to try to save the lives of thousands of people in Korea, because she is at this point, she is aware of this danger. And she's like, okay, this, I can't be part of this. Can't you see what a problem this is? And he can't see it, that it's a problem, because he can't see past. It's just like her telling him what to do.
Well, and this is where I have a problem with the movie's metaphors, because here she's had her fun and she sees, I believe this is the right thing to do. Now, she could, of course, just go call the cops and be like, hey, look, she could have turned herself in and said, look what I can do. And he wants to do it, too. You should probably stop him from doing this. Obviously, there's a lot of logic that could have been overcome. She's never really. And again, you can make an argument for a trapped, abusive relationship kind of thing here. But really, she starts to want to control right off the bat. She wants to control him. The movie is supposed to be saying something about the men that want
to
control her.
She wants to keep him from killing thousands of people in Korea.
I don't believe that. I believe she wanted to manipulate him how she wanted to. She didn't care about the killing of the people that much when she swatted at helicopters. She knew it was going to happen.
She went to the effort of writing "I'm sorry" in Korean.
Oh, that was so great! what an amazing gesture that she made. She wanted to do it on her own. She wanted to be the only one who said "I'm sorry." She didn't want to have anything else, him involved at all. It was all about her. She wanted eyes on her. You have to listen to me. She wants to take
responsibility, which is fine.
Oh, please! She didn't care about responsibility. She didn't care about that at all. She cared about her feelings. About any subject in this movie. What's her feelings? Other people's feelings did not matter to her one bit. Not a single person's feelings mattered to her in this film. Not one. She didn't mind blowing off her ex-boyfriend when they're on Skype and she just leaves the house all of a sudden. She didn't mind hanging out.
That was amazing.
And she's the one that called him. Like, she didn't care. It didn't matter to her at all. None of this. Nobody mattered to her at all. There wasn't a single person that she cared about other than herself in this entire film. So really, like, I hated her. And I would have liked to seen her, you know, drop kicked somewhere as well. But I did also think, like, and Sudeikis would have been much better off not representing some sort of abusive relationship, which she was never in. She was the abuser in her former relationship. I think Sudeikis would have been better representing the disease itself of alcoholism as opposed to maybe even the monsters, because that sort of trapped thing, like him making her do these certain things, almost reminded me of how, or almost seemed like how an alcoholic would be battling with themselves, almost like he was the devil on her shoulder kind of thing, to do these, you know, I don't know, that would have been a much more, it would have been less clumsy than what they turned it into.
I'm not going to disagree that the movie is clumsy as hell. I think I've laid out a case for that already. But I totally can't get behind the notion that without her in town, everything is hunky-dory and he's completely fine. I mean, we see him as a kid, and he's this spiteful, angry, confused. We don't know a lot about it. We know that his parents die, and we know that, you know, he likes to stomp the hell out of this little girl's model of soul.
No kid has ever done that before. Every kid who's ever done something like that grew up to be a monster.
Well, in this movie he did, and you know, we can see that his life is in shambles. We can see that he is desperately unhappy. We can see that he's probably abused at least one woman before. We can see that he has this, you know, he has these codependent friends that he has just an awful, that he thinks very little of, and I guarantee you, based on this characterization, like, this is not the first time he's lashed out at people. We don't see it in the movie because it's outside the scope, but people like this, you know, people, you know, abusers and people who have these, who you know, seek to control and dominate, they don't exist in a vacuum, and they don't only do it to one person. That's not how they work.
Well, so I can argue against this very thing in the lashing out scene. The reaction of Tim Blake Nelson's character to the lashing out suggests that this was a total shock to him, and something like this had never been done before. And they were suggested to be
maybe
very,
not to him,
like his good friends. Yes, but it's, the entire thing seemed like a shock to him.
Maybe there's a reason he only has two friends.
Well, I don't know, but the problem is the movie doesn't know either. You can't have reactions like that signify one thing, but then try to tell me, well, you know, he probably has done this before, except that it doesn't look like that. It doesn't look like he's ever done this before to those people. Tim Blake Nelson walks out and we never see him again for the rest of the movie. So it's not like the movie even demonstrated, oh, he's done this before to his friends and they keep coming back. That guy never came back. And that suggests to me that he never did that before to that guy. That Tim Blake Nelson's character looked shocked that it happened in the first place. And he reacted as if, like, basically said, screw you, I'm out of here, how dare you? Meaning he probably hadn't seen that before even. I'm going off of what's actually in the movie, not what I suppose Jason Sudeikis' character might have been like outside of this movie.
Well,
evidence given to me suggests one thing.
I mean, I'm supposing this based purely on how people behave when they're like this. I mean, it's, again,
right.
like
but
you...
But the movie doesn't... You're right, though. You're absolutely right that that is a thing. The movie does not convey that very well at all.
I can agree with that the movie is out of step and maybe doesn't dramatize it well, but to characterize that as being... as that ultimately she's the abuser, she's the master manipulator, is, I think, completely back-ass words.
Well, she is an abuser. I mean, you have to admit, she is a manipulator and an abuser. The movie demonstrates that plenty of times as well.
She's a manipulator,
also, she's like,
absolutely, but, I mean, there's a fine line between manipulation and abuse.
I think she's abusing Tim, for sure, and she was abusing Joel in some respects as well.
Well, I mean, we should probably move on from this topic, but I think that...
Regardless to say I hate her as a character, I
can see that. Very obvious.
I would have gladly accepted her fate to be the same as Jason Sudeikis. Both of them could have been.
Here's the thing: I don't think she's that bad to the extent. If the movie had gone towards the direction of just they became just like the sort of increasingly codependent alcoholics, then I totally would have bought the two of them, like the two of them, like almost like fight each other to the death as the fight to the death between the monsters plays out in Soul. But I still see her, I see it more. She's a fuck up. She acknowledges that there's consequences to the fuck ups. She tries to change them. You see that she basically tries to stop drinking at a certain point, and then she because the other person who this applies to can't deal with it. He keeps trying to drag her back into it and then using this what he knows about this to control her.
She's a terrorist.
And I think that it sells. And for me, it sells that.
What it doesn't sell for me is that she accepts consequences, because I don't see at any point where she is genuinely sorry for how she has treated anybody at all. Like, I get what you're saying about this. She didn't want to wreck Seoul, Korea. I get that. Like, but that doesn't, I didn't actually see that it was because she felt so awful. And that's, again, that's the large scale thing. What about the relationships that she's been in, the personal relationships that she's been in where she has messed up? Because essentially the Seoul, Korea thing is a metaphor for how I'm assuming that the monster is kind of a metaphor for how she is wrought destruction in her personal life. Well, we don't actually see any evidence of her facing any consequences or accepting any consequences whatsoever for what she's done in her personal life. Actually, we're supposed to buy that her actions trying to, like, destroy more people's lives are actually heroic in some way.
I think we should probably stop trying to hash out that particular issue. But Les, you were kind of teasing
before.
We could
agree on everything, Simon.
You were kind of teasing before, Les, something that was going to make us angry, which I can't imagine anything that would make anyone angrier right now.
Okay. Oh. Well, get ready for this, because I was talking and I was dissecting this in my head. I was actually dissecting a little bit of this in my head because there were parallels to this and another movie I saw recently. And I think that this one actually, and I was just sort of toying. I kept arguing with myself which one I liked better, this or Get Out.
Oh, interesting.
Well, Patrick hated Get Out, so this will be interesting.
I like Get Out better. I didn't hate Get Out as much. I didn't hate Get Out. I shouldn't say that. Did I say that on the podcast? I thought it was okay, but vastly overrated. I had a lot of problems with Get Out, but that was an okay movie.
Get Out is a vastly superior, intellectually coherent, at 100%, like, I know that you're going to disagree with this part, Patrick, but completely crackerjack pacing compared to this, moved like clockwork, whereas this movie just moves like work. I mean, we haven't even gotten into the filmmaking and the mechanics, which is what I originally said I was going to hope to emphasize. But
my argument is because both movies are also Right. Well, and maybe this can help you help us lead into some of the technical discussion. Like, both of these movies are writer director. So they're very much the execution of the vision of their creator's specific vision.
Sure.
And both movies are sort of relying on the actual villains of the movie are like, I mean, Get Out's villain is essentially casual racism. Colossal's villains are domestic abuse. But I just kind of went back and forth because I enjoyed both movies a lot. I don't know, I feel like, well, say what you will about tone, but Colossal didn't have a TSA agent doing shtick for various little parts of it. So Colossal, at least I thought, has that going for coherency.
Well, you're right, because the funny parts of Get Out are actually funny. Whereas, like, there are very few, like, attempts at humor in this movie, and that actually work. I mean, I will admit, in the initial sequences where they're sort of, you know, dueling and you can hear people cheering from the houses, like, that was kind of a novel touch that I kind of chuckled at. But beyond that, like, it's remarkable to me that this guy made Time Crimes, which I guess neither of you have seen, but that movie is hilarious and just a blackly funny take on time travel movies. It's sort of like if Primer was a black comedy.
Primer is so fucking good.
Yeah, imagine like Primer meets like this is a bad comparison, but like an early Neil LaBute film or something. Like,
whoa, okay.
Yeah, like it's not quite that level of misanthropy, but it's pretty close.
In the company of Primer.
It's, I mean, I haven't seen Time Crimes in a while, so I would need to reassess, especially after having seen this, but it's got a really dark sensibility and it's very macabre, but it's also really, really funny and voyeuristic and evocative, and also looks like it was made on, like, as my old roommate Eduardo used to say, 10 pesos. Whereas this movie has like a, you know, probably 100 times the budget and, you know, marquee actors, et cetera, and the execution on every level just feels so slapshod. I mean, right down to like the notion of ending this movie with, you know, this scene in a Seoul bar where she sort of slumps down in a chair and this kind of goes to your point, Patrick, much as I disagree with a lot of your characterization of her, the relationships and the nature of abuse. It goes to your point about how she doesn't feel responsibility. In the end, this is all just like a wacky story to her that she's going to like recount to people. And she, you know, the fact of like, again, the thousands of possibly tens of thousands of deaths that are never depicted, never seen. You know, that's just, you know, that's kind of a background for a funny story now. Like, oh,
want a drink? And yeah, then the cute little, here we go again.
Shucks. Whoop-de-doop credits.
How amazing would it have been if she told the story and then they called her and then the government of Korea showed up to arrest her for crimes against humanity?
And just shot her in the face on the spot. Yeah. yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. Comparing this to Get Out is a very, very loaded thing. Again, I think that movie is way, way more considered. Oh, and speaking of this movie being racist, it's absolutely obscene to me that Vigilando thought it was cool to like reuse like kaiju tropes and essentially make his Godzilla movie. Apparently, when this movie was being marketed to buyers, they actually used like actual Godzilla imagery, and Taiho tried to sue them. And I think it was actually like settled out of court or something. So that, you know, clearly they knew what they were doing. You know, Godzilla is a movie about, you know, nuclear proliferation and like the fears of like global destruction and, you know, these really heavy things. But you know, the Godzilla movies are silly, and you know, this movie tries to like reclaim, you know, this imagery in the service of like serious themes, which is something that I've noticed happens every few years. Like indie filmmakers will like try to like class up genre elements by like attaching them to these like sad sack stories of white millennials. Like this happened a few years ago with the atrocious Another Earth, a movie I completely fucking hated, where like,
is that Another Earth or After Earth?
No, Another Earth. This is the one, you know, starring, oh God, I want to say her name is Britt Robertson, the one who was just in, the OA.
Britt Marling.
Yes. Thank you. She also wrote the film, and you know, it's this movie about, essentially a clone of Earth shows up in like Earth's orbit and, you know, also containing another 7 billion people. But the planet basically ends up just, like, acting as a metaphor about her own grief. And it's just, it's the most, it's just as misconceived as this movie is. You know, this notion that for these, you know, hoary old genre tropes to be, like, classed up and be acceptable to, like, mainstream audiences or even to art house audiences or whatever, they need to be, like, tied in with this, like, bullshit Sundance plot. Which is, again, this movie is another example of that, and it feels, like, really, like, retrograde and awful to me.
I think what offended me the most about this movie, besides the characterization, which obviously I have a thing for, and by the way, Get Out, you're right, is vastly superior to this movie. And you can go listen to the podcast, you know, the show that we did about Get Out to see what I thought of that movie. The way that it's shot, you're talking about, like, this having 100 times the budget of, you know, Time, what was that called?
Time Crimes.
Well, it doesn't look like it. This thing looks like it's as low budget as all hell, and there's no inventiveness whatsoever. This looks like, I didn't know anything about this filmmaker until I saw this movie, so I had to look him up. I assumed it was a first-time movie because of just how incompetent he was at composing most of his shots and a lot of the editing. This is basically like the George Lucas prequel school of conversations. It was just all covered.
Whoa. Let's not say things we can't take back.
I mean it 100%. It's like, here we go. We've got our close-up, our medium shot, and our coverage. Boom. That's it. Scene done. Every scene was shot that way. Every single one. There wasn't a single attempt at any sort of artistic element in this movie except for one shot Jason Sudeikis commits an act of violence, and there's a little bit of, like, a silhouette of him from behind that totally did a good job conveying how, you know, how he had sort of turned the corner into pure evil. If you weren't convinced before, you'd definitely be convinced after that. So that was the only sort of artistic shot in the entire movie, and the rest of it is so bland. And it's almost confusing sometimes in the way that it's edited too, the way that it's put together. I didn't necessarily understand what time of day it was all the time until characters started beating you over the head with 805, 805, 805. And I didn't understand necessarily. I didn't know anything about the town, how it looked, how she was walking everywhere with it. What kind of town was this? I didn't know anything. The way it's shot is utterly confusing to me.
Yeah, I will agree with that one. Like, I could try to figure out where the hell is this movie set? I think, don't they actually say that the town's name is called Mainland or something?
I don't remember.
It was any town, USA, basically.
Yeah.
At one point, just for my own self amusement, I said, okay, they're in Derry, Maine. I'm not really a huge like craft of film guy. I'm more of a story character sort of guy, so won't speak too much to that, though I will say I think the sort of out of time concept of the movie that actually sort of worked in its favor, because like the sort of emphasizing that she's just kind of plodding along, getting drunk, passing out on benches, so it's just her life is just kind of passing by and nothing actually is happening beyond her drinking and messing shit up until that one time shows up where suddenly, where she quite literally has to at one point snap awake.
He relied, it seemed like as filmmaking wise, he was going for something as basic as he possibly could, and he was relying on a script that could not handle the rest of it. Actors, he actually surrounded himself with a decent cast, but
yeah,
he didn't have anything for them to do.
Random question. How much of that $15 million do you think went to pay Anne Hathaway's salary for this?
I hope not too much.
I feel like a lot of the money for this movie went to getting Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis.
Well, it definitely didn't go to the effects. Ayo!
Yeah, no, it didn't. Although it seemed like they were splitting time between a guy in a rubber suit and CGI, which was fine. The monster, didn't really care. Like, yeah, it looked really goofy. But, I mean, ultimately, I would have liked to have seen them shoot and done something other than the exact same interior shots over and over and over again. It was so obvious that they did not have money for sets here. Seeing the bar over and over again from the exact same angles, too. Like, just try to mix it up a little bit. You know, Sidney Lumet shot 12 Angry Men all in the same room, and somehow he found ways to make that visually interesting for 2 hours. Like, they couldn't do any of this.
which again I think was sort of meant to be some of the point, just like the blandness of their existence, that they're just hanging out at this bar over and over again, having the same conversations over and over again until they set off a giant firework in it.
Well, he totally succeeded. I did not want to hang out with this movie or those people because they were so bland.
Yeah,
right.
I felt bad for Joe. He never got his coffee.
Yeah, that's true. What was the point of that conversation?
There was one point in the conversation where he was talking about, like, we were sort of talking about just his life falling apart. He mentioned that he used to go out shooting off fireworks with his buddies, and they just didn't do that anymore. So another side of just life kind of falling apart.
That was definitely character development for him. I just want to know why Joe was even included in any of that. Was it supposed to be funny that he kept denying this guy coffee? I guess so. The actual story of the fireworks thing was a decent little speech, I thought.
I thought that whole scene, I can't even remember Dan Stevens' character name.
Tim.
So, Tim. Okay. Fuck it. I'm just gonna call him David because I just finished watching Legion. And also, this movie would have been so. I will say. Regardless, I like this movie. It would have been so much better if there were psychokinetic abilities.
Definitely. Yeah.
But just like the whole thing, the sort of weird power plays that were going on between David and I'm just gonna stick with this right now. David and Oscar and Gloria. Just like he keeps ordering her to the bar. And again, I thought, like, we praised Jason Sudeikis. Like, I thought I enjoyed the way he delivered that monologue, and I thought it was funny the way he kept not giving Joe his coffee. And this is also the scene that ended with that, like the scene, he's like, you're not coming, you're not going with him. And she says nothing. I thought all of that played out really well, because a lot of it was just, oh shit, what's going to happen next sort of thing.
That right. might have been the best scene in the movie, actually.
Yeah, I would actually agree with that. And I think that goes to Sudeikis' performance.
Congratulations!
We found one thing.
All three of us have about this movie.
Maybe that's as good a point as any to end things off, because we have gone slightly long, which is a little bit shocking to me. I thought we'd have this wrapped up in a tidy 40, but in conclusion, even though I definitely don't see eye to eye with all of Patrick's criticisms, I do think this movie is an absolute misbegotten failure, and I'm stunned at how bad it is and how. Like I also discussed this film with my good friend Kate Rennebaum, who's been on this podcast before, because she and I saw it the same night, and I wanted her on this podcast to talk about it, but she hated it so much that she didn't want to. She was so angry. She was like, honestly, Simon, I don't want to give that movie another hour of my life. She was as demoralized by it as I was, and like, so clearly there's something in the water where it's really resonating with some people and just absolutely pissing the hell out of everyone else.
Yeah. And I understand, and I in several cases agree with a lot of the criticisms you guys have brought up about the film, but just I do not understand the sheer loathing that this film seems to have engendered in people. I mean, yes, could it have been more effective in its execution of certain themes? Absolutely, but I don't know. For me, I thought the performances were great. I enjoyed the themes the movie was going for, and I honestly did. And again, to keep angering, this movie probably will wind up in my top 10 this year. So
wow.
I see the problems. I enjoyed it.
All right.
Yeah, and you're obviously in the majority on that. I'm now fascinated by how we've had, like, it's not just me and Simon, but Simon, you said Kate, and then my friend Allie as well. Also. Just had this terrible, terrible reaction. Like, I mean, she and I talked about this for 2 hours, and I'm a lot of what I'm relating to you, I'm getting through our conversation. Like, she was agreeing with me on the same things. It's interesting how it inspired this loathing in us, but the vast majority of people have really, really liked this movie. So
yeah,
I will be interested to see, because it's not very widely released at this point. I think there's only one theater in Portland, Oregon. I think there's only one theater showing it right now. And that probably actually shows. I went to the Wikipedia since we were talking about money. Yeah, the budget was $15 million. It's currently only made $1.35 million.
So it's probably going
congrats.
Wider.
Probably.
Yeah.
So I will be curious to see what, like, again, since it's obviously a lot more polarizing than initial impressions would lead you to believe. So I will be curious to see just when this finally starts to germinate more into the public, how, if it's as divisive with everyone else as it's been with, well, us.
Yeah. I mean, I think that to quickly explain why I think it's gotten such a good reception. I mean, I think that critics who see 300 movies a year are desperate for something novel. And I'll give the movie this. It is novel. There's not going to be another movie like this year. And I think a lot of critics probably just read the synopsis and were sold right there. I mean, some critics that I really love and respect, I think were totally bamboozled by this movie. And I'm not going to name names, but I was shocked when I went through the Rotten Tomatoes and saw who some of the raves were from. But anyway, I'm not going to judge people for disagreeing with me, except silently. anyway,
the only negative review I saw, the only negative review on Metacritic was from Rex Reed. That was it. Otherwise, everybody was either mediocre or positive.
God, I hate that I'm on the same page with Rex Reed and no one else.
He gave it a zero. So yes, it's you and me and Rex Reed.
Wow, that makes me feel like garbage. But anyway, sorry, Rex Reed. Anyway, thanks, Les, for coming on. Where can people find you online?
You can find my stuff at abclub.com, currently reviewing Silicon Valley and Superstore, and follow me on Twitter at Les, L-E-S-I-S-M-O-R-E 909. So Les is more 909.
Fantastic. I'm on Twitter at HollowMinds, but as I always tell people, I mostly just retweet mean socialists now, so you may not want to follow me. And Patrick, I know that you're
not
really a social
really
media
Twitter.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not really even on Twitter at all. I've dabbled in the past, but I've never really gone with it. But you can always find the stuff that I write on goombastomp.com under, you know, Sorted Cinema or even some of the video game stuff.
Fantastic. And you'll find my review of Colossal on Sorted Cinema as well. Although, you know, there's obviously going to be a lot of rehashing of what you've already heard, so you know that may or may not interest all of you. I would be very curious to hear from listeners or people in the community about how they felt about this film and its themes and its execution and all that stuff. But we've really got to go. Thank y'all so much for joining me, and thank y'all for listening. We'll be back next week.
When they started downsizing, I was the first to go. Oh, you jerk! You already knew.
Yes. Sorry.
Why? Yeah. Why didn't you tell me? Why are you letting me like?
Well, I don't know. I didn't want you to think I was creepy, like I'm some sort of stalker.
Oh, well, it's too late for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've been following me all these years?
Of course I have. Somebody actually made it out of here and did something special for once. Hell, look what had to happen for things to get interesting around here.
Giants attacking South Korea.
No. I mean you.
Dark, but I'd warn him, it's hard.